If we looked just at the phrase election day, what would we take from that?
Well, Justice Sam Alito, I think in this case we would take that you're corrupt and trying to disenfranchise voters.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's what I would look at.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Yes, it is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and on dozens of other fine affiliate stations on both the public airwaves and the internets around the country and the world, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, an all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com, with a lot to get to on today's broadcast, though, so thank you for joining us for it. Donald Trump's historically disastrous, no seeming way out, war on Iran grinds on today after Trump claimed to have held back on the war crime of bombing civilian power plants in Iran while claiming that talks with Iran's top leadership were ongoing and making excellent progress, even though he could not identify who in Iran was actually being spoken to. And Iran was insisting that there were no talks going on with U.S. at the time, even through intermediaries. Time will tell who was the biggest liar in that scenario. And I'm sure we will spend some time on that with Digby and Driftglass when they join us again on tomorrow's program for another roundtable discussion. But for the moment, I want to bring things back home here to our elections, specifically our November elections, our critical 2026 midterms, and even more specifically, an incredibly disturbing and or alarming oral argument that happened at the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court on Monday, which could, depending on how the corrupt right-wing justices there rule on the matter, have a huge effect on our elections this year, and not in a good way. The great Mark Joseph Stern of Slate will join us momentarily to discuss that. And Desi Doyen, hello.
Hi.
You will have our latest Green News report today thereafter.
Yes, I will.
If time allows.
Oh, it'll allow.
So, a lot to get to, but let me set the table with this first, a follow-up to our coverage of North Carolina's 2026 primary results from earlier in the month on March 3. At the time, we told you that the powerful North Carolina State Senate President pro tempore, Phil Berger, was running at the time just 2 votes out of more than 26,000 cast behind his Republican primary challenger in that primary, Sam Page, the Rockingham County Sheriff, despite Senator Berger having the endorsement of Donald Trump in that election. He was running behind by 2 votes, according to the unofficial state election results at the time, and that given the ridiculously thin margin there, there would probably be a recount. Well, that recount officially ended on Thursday. After several weeks of careful hand counting, it looks like Republican State Senate Leader Phil Berger, North Carolina government's most influential politician, who led the party's rampage to strip powers from the governor's office after Democrats started winning over the past 3 statewide elections there, and the man who was endorsed by Donald Trump this year, well, he conceded the primary race for his seat in a Republican-leaning district to Sam Page, shaking the power structure in the 9th largest state, as AP describes it today, and likely soon ending Berger's preeminence as the state's top conservative architect. Berger has been the Senate leader since 2011, when Republicans took full control over the General Assembly for the first time in 140 years. But it looks like now he concedes to having lost by 23 votes in the March 3 election, proving yet again that, yes, every vote counts, and that a Donald Trump endorsement is no longer a guaranteed victory in this year's elections. Berger led the state legislature to gerrymander the Democratic-leaning Democratic-leaning U.S. House seat in North Carolina to favor Republicans this year, that at the request of Trump, and now Berger is out of power himself.
By only 23 votes.
Meanwhile, out here in California, a state sheriff who is running as a Republican for governor this year has seized more than 650,000 ballots from last year's special election, a statewide special election in California, escalating an ongoing conflict with state officials. Chad Bianco, Riverside County's sheriff and a Trump supporter who's locked in a battle with a fellow Republican and former Fox News host for a top slot in the state's general election this fall, says that he's carrying out this investigation into allegations by a supposed election integrity group calling themselves the Riverside Election Integrity Team. I've never heard of them, but whatever. They claim that 45,000 ballots were unlawfully cast in last year's election, the special election that resulted in the passage of Prop 50. That was the proposition which won by about 3.5 million votes across the state last year, redrawing congressional districts in California to help gerrymander the state in favor of Democrats in response to similar measures by Trump-loving Republican legislatures in states like Texas and, yes, North Carolina. Election officials and the California Attorney General, Rob Bonta, have dismissed the allegations being made by Bianco. The discrepancy between the machine count and the final count submitted to the state, made after a careful post-election canvass by officials, is just 103 votes, according to the Riverside Record, which is not particularly unusual. Bianco's investigators obtained these ballots, about 650,000, after serving the county's registrar of voters with search warrants last month, he explained on Friday at a press conference. John Fleischman, the former executive director of the California Republican Party, told the New York Times, quote, "It looks to me like it's a politically motivated effort."
You think?
Well, I don't know. I don't know about these supposed 45,000 votes and where they came from or if they even exist. But here you have the former leader of the California Republican Party calling this move by a Republican candidate for governor, like a politically motivated effort. He also said it's awfully coincidental that he would be taking this high profile and extreme action literally 2 months before he is facing a statewide election in June. Shirley Weber, California's Democratic Secretary of State, denounced the investigation as well, said that the claims made by Mr. Bianco were not backed by evidence. Moreover, a sheriff's department, she said, was not properly equipped to conduct such an election review. She said in the statement on Friday, quote, "Investigations into election processes must be conducted by those with the appropriate legal authority and subject matter expertise." Similar claims, she said, raised in other states by individuals without election administration experience have been thoroughly reviewed and debunked. She's likely referring there to the laughable so-called recount after 2020 in Maricopa County, Arizona, a few years ago by the Republican group calling itself Cyber Ninjas, which found not only that, yes, Joe Biden did beat Donald Trump in Arizona's largest county that year, according to the flawed Cyber Ninjas count, but Biden actually won by more votes than was originally reported in the official tallies. Back to California, Rob Bonta, the Democratic Attorney General in the state, issued a stern rebuke of Sheriff Bianco's investigation in a letter earlier this month, which took particular issue with Bianco's plan to use his own staff to audit the ballots. "This is unacceptable," Bonta wrote. "Your decision to seize ballots and begin counting them based on vague, unsubstantiated allegations about irregularities in the November special election, sets a dangerous precedent and will sow distrust in our elections. So what ended up happening here for a time is the count was actually stopped, challenged in court, and a Riverside Superior Court judge has now appointed a special master to oversee this count of ballots, ordering the sheriff's office to restart the count under the eyes of the special master. Sheriff Bianco said on Friday, "This investigation is simple. Physically count the ballots and compare that result with the total votes recorded. We will see. We will see how all of this works out." The Attorney General Bonta called Bianco's move unprecedented, says it was designed to sow distrust in elections. Bianco is one of the two most prominent Republicans running in California's crowded gubernatorial primary. It includes more than half a dozen Democrats. California runs a top two primary system, which puts all of the candidates onto the same ballot, regardless of party, and the two top vote getters, again, regardless of party, who get the most vote, move on to the November general election. So that could be two Republicans, that could be two Democrats, that could be one of each. And there are so many Democrats running right now that, Bianco's fellow Republican in the race is Steve Hilton. Those two are now deadlocked, according to a recent UC Berkeley poll, with, I think, 17% support for Hilton, 16% for Sheriff Bianco. And yet that is more than any Democrat currently in the race right now, because there are so many of them running for those two top slots. Anyway, that's something we'll get to on another day, I suspect.
Yes.
We will, of course, keep our eyes in the meantime on whatever happens in this weird, frankly, unprecedented to my knowledge, Riverside count after the seizure of ballots by a county sheriff. And speaking of fraud and false claims about it by Donald Trump, particularly when it comes to vote by mail, Donald Trump cast what would be an unlawful ballot, apparently, if it was up to Donald Trump when he cast a mail ballot for an upcoming Florida special election. That, according to Palm Beach County records, even as Trump publicly condemns the voting method as fraudulent and indeed actually had his own Solicitor General at the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday this week arguing exactly that. Trump himself said on Monday, quote, "Mail-in voting means mail-in cheating. I call it mail-in cheating, and we got to do something about it all, he said. But public records indicate his own mail ballot was received and counted by election officials in Palm Beach County, where he is registered to vote. It is a familiar refrain and action from Trump, notes NBC. Trump has often criticized mail voting as rife with fraud. He has used such rhetoric to push a massive elections overhaul bill in Congress. He's called the Save America Act, which, if adopted, would lead to the disenfranchisement of millions of otherwise lawful American voters and end the ability of many Americans to vote by mail at all, like Donald Trump did this week, even though the bill wouldn't end mail voting entirely, as he suggests in his public comments. So what was the hypocritical Trump arguing at the U.S. Supreme Court on Monday? And how many voters will be disenfranchised if his argument wins the day there, as many corporate outlets suggested was likely to be the case on Monday night? Well, we will see if they are right about that. We'll take a quick break here. We'll be back with the great legal reporter, Mark Joseph Stern, who will be here to explain. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to The Bradcast. Hey, this is Brad. Here at The Bradcast and bradblog.com, we fight for election integrity all year around, like no other media outlet in the nation. But of course, we need your help to help us remain on your public airwaves and completely independent. Please help us continue that fight over your public airwaves by stopping by bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
It's not too late to turn this ship around, to sail into the wind, my love, before we run aground. It's not too late.
Well, it may be too late if your ballot arrives after Election Day, at least if the Supreme Court has the Republicans on the Supreme Court have their way, at least some of them. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The right wing of the corrupted U.S. Supreme Court happily churned out far-fetched election and voting hypotheticals as rationale to end a long-standing voting practice so common that 30 states currently use it, including Ruby Red, Mississippi, which was defending its version of that law during Monday's oral arguments at the High Court, defending its election practice against the Republican Party itself. Yes, the Republican Secretary of State in Deep Red, Mississippi, was forced to defend, or in this case, sue to protect, I guess, its own election laws against the RNC. In the case named Michael Watson, Mississippi Secretary of State versus Republican National Committee. Mississippi's law, and the many like it across the country, allow mailed ballots to be counted if they were sent by Election Day but arrive afterwards. The practice is so common, it's used in 30 states across the country. And of course, if you think about it, it makes sense. If someone drops their ballot in a mailbox before Election Day and it's postmarked to prove as much, but for whatever reason it arrives after Election Day, why shouldn't it be counted? Should a voter lose their right to vote simply because the post office, for whatever reason, and the reasons could be nefarious or benign, simply because the post office fails to deliver a ballot before the end of Election Day? Should I be disenfranchised because of that? As long as the court on Monday seemed obsessed with far-fetched hypotheticals, how about if a voter mailed her ballot a month before the election, but it still showed up the day after the election? Should she lose her right to vote because of it, even though it's postmarked weeks earlier? Voting by mail, as you know, has become a stupidly contentious political issue in the last several years because, and only because, as I would argue, Donald Trump claimed falsely that it somehow helped his enemies to steal the election from him in 2020, even though in the more than 5 years since then, there has been zero evidence of mass election fraud from vote by mail or anything else discovered by anyone in that election. As TPM's Kate Riga observed, faced with the inconvenient reality that voting by mail is not actually rife with fraud, many of the far-right justices had to content themselves with increasingly hallucinatory what-ifs. As our friend Chris Geidner of Law Dork cited at one point, Justice Neil Gorsuch, quote, went into hyperdrive, presenting a monster hypothetical that took over a disproportionate part of the rest of the morning.
So here's the hypo. Let's say you have a state where a large portion of the electorate mails in their ballots on or close to Election Day. Not far-fetched. Many states are like that. Then, the day after the election, a story breaks that one of the lead candidates engaged in an inappropriate sexual escapade, or perhaps is concluding with a foreign power. Again, not far-fetched, I think. And the competing candidate immediately goes on the airwaves and urges voters to recall their ballots and to tell the common carriers not to deliver them. And many common carriers will do that with anything that you send through them. FedEx, you just call them up and say, I want it back. In that hypothetical, did the election happen on Election Day? Oh, by the way, it swings the election.
In that hypothetical, pigs are also flying, it seems to me. Now, I don't know how many people, vote by FedEx, but despite my more than 22 years at this point of covering elections, perhaps as close as any journalist in America, I gotta say, I am not sure if I recall ever hearing about any attempt to recall ballots after Election Day, or in truth, even before Election Day, much less some sort of movement that would somehow steal an election that we have to protect against. Nonetheless, after Gorsuch's insane hypothetical, not based on any real live election in the nearly 250-year history of the U.S., to my knowledge, as Geithner points out, the word recall was then used 40 more times in the course of the arguments at the Supreme Court on Monday. Incredibly enough, many on the right, according to Riga at TPM, sounded Trumpian in their feigned concern about voting fraud. Justice Brett Kavanaugh fretted over the chance that late arriving ballots would prompt cries of fraud, creating a, quote, perception that lawful elections might appear rigged. As has become rote for the court's far-right wingers, in the absence of any actual evidence of fraud, they fell back on the impossible-to-substantiate risk that people might think something fishy is going on. These rabbit holes, she writes, which tripped up Mississippi Solicitor General Scott Stewart, distracted from the meat of Monday's attempt by the Republican National Committee and the Trump administration to make voting by mail harder to do, because Democrats vote by mail more in recent history. For the record, it was not that many years ago that it was Republicans who used absentee voting more than Democrats, though there was little concern about voters wanting to recall their late arriving ballots after Election Day throughout all of those years for some reason. As our friend Mark Joseph Stern over at Slate cuts straight to the heart of the matter, as usual, the Supreme Court, he writes, may be poised to commit the single biggest act of disenfranchisement in modern history in a direct assault on the constitutional authority of states to set election laws. During Monday's argument in Watson v. Republican National Committee, the conservative justices lined up to attack state laws permitting the counting of ballots that arrive shortly after Election Day if they were postmarked on time. Now, Mark calls them conservative justices. I call them far-right or Republican-appointed justices because there is nothing conservative, as far as I can tell, about what these radical right-wing justices are now. According to most observers, as of Monday's proceedings, seriously seeming prepared to do. In 2024 alone, Mark notes, more than 750,000 late arriving ballots were counted because of a state's grace period. Now, there is a very real chance, he says, that the Supreme Court will wipe out these laws in one fell swoop, causing chaos in the upcoming midterms that could, by the way, disproportionately impact Democratic voters. That news in itself, he says, is a five-alarm fire for democracy, he warns. Joining us now is our longtime friend, Mark Joseph Stern, who covers the law, the court system, the U.S. Supreme Court, election law, and so much more as a longtime senior writer at Slate.com. Oh, Mark Joseph Stern, welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here as always.
You argue in your piece at Slate last night that, quote, what makes all of this even more disturbing is the fact that so many justices proved eager to embrace a legal theory that is incoherent, dishonest, and rooted in paranoid hostility toward mail voting. All right, I'll bite. What is that legal theory and how did they embrace it, Mark?
The legal theory is that Congress somehow prohibited states from counting these late arriving mail ballots when it sets the federal date of elections. So just to be clear, at no point has Congress ever passed a law that says that states cannot count late arriving ballots. Actually, there are very few laws that even govern mail voting. All that Congress has ever done is said that the first Tuesday after the first Monday is, quote, Election Day. And the legal theory in this case, I'm not joking, is that the words Election Day contain some kind of implicit prohibition on states counting ballots that are mailed by Election Day that arrive shortly thereafter. That's the plaintiff's theory. They've got nothing better than that. And yet here we are talking about arguments which obviously went very well for them, an indication that this court is, as we've discussed, as you know better than most, extremely eager to interfere with free and fair elections, extremely hostile toward mail voting, and very, very, I think, sympathetic to Donald Trump's persistent claims that our voting system is rife with fraud.
So is that why this notion that that Congress, I guess, 150 years ago or whenever it was, declared that the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November would be Election Day, that was Election Day. Is that why Alito was arguing that Election Day, as defined by Congress, could only be on this one single day and everything else, therefore, is not Election Day? So ballots may not be cast or counted on any other day when Alito said, and I quote, "We have lots of phrases that involve two words, the second day of which is day. Labor Day, Memorial Day, George Washington's birthday." That's 3 days, but three words, but okay. Independence Day, birthday. That one got two mentions, I guess. And Election Day. He said they are all particular days. So if we start with that, if I have nothing more to look at than the phrase Election Day, I think this is the day in which everything is going to take place. Did I read that quote correctly, Mark? Is that the argument that he's actually making, because it has the word day in it? That's the day. Therefore, nothing else can happen on any other day.
So, look, you articulated the argument correctly. I think that you're leading to, just by stating it, all the reasons it's wrong. And if I could just get a head start there, of course, the reality is that we do not all vote on Election Day, and our ballots are not all counted on Election Day. And that has been the case for a very long time. So if the plaintiff's theory is correct, and if Alito is correct, that the day is the day, that there is this 24-hour period where everything has to happen, then early voting is illegal.
Right.
Mail voting is illegal. And no ballots can be counted after midnight on Election Day, because it's the day. And, you know, if it's not your birthday after midnight, then it can't be Election Day after midnight. And there has to be a timer that goes off. And every ballot that hasn't been counted just needs to be set on fire because the day is over. That's the implication of his theory.
Right. I mean, it seems like it would kill early voting and any kind of vote by mail, because obviously that has to be done prior to the election.
In advance.
Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, did that come up as an argument? Was that an effective rebuttal to this claim? Because that claim about Election Day seems to be at the heart of this case. It was, as it was originally decided, I guess, by the far right Fifth Circuit Court back in 2024, when they initially blocked Mississippi's law on this on these grace periods.
That is correct. I mean, the problem for the plaintiffs was so obvious that it came up over and over again, and remarkably, to my mind, they didn't really have a very good argument against it. So even Chief Justice John Roberts, who I think is like a major swing vote in this case, he kept asking, well, if your theory is that it all has to happen on the day, then how could you possibly think early voting is okay? And the answer given by Paul Clement, who was attacking the Mississippi law, was basically that early voting is just different. It just is. It's different because it is. And the chief made fun of him. I mean, the chief made fun of the Solicitor General, too, John Sauer, who was on behalf of the Trump administration also attacking mail voting, and basically said, you don't have an argument. It's completely circular. You're just saying that, you know, early voting is different and late arriving ballots are different, but you don't have a reason why. And I think Justice Amy Coney Barrett was, to her credit, concerned about this as well. I mean, if you take these theories seriously, it means that the way that we have conducted elections in this country for a very long time, I mean, actually going back to the Civil War, which we can talk about, has been unlawful, and nobody knew it until now. Congress secretly smuggled in this ban on early voting, and nobody figured it out until the geniuses on the Fifth Circuit did in 2024.
It's just, I mean, I guess by that notion, Donald Trump, I think on Monday, violated the law by voting by mail in Florida. So somebody really needs to round him up for voter fraud, I guess. This argument, Mark, about the threat of appearance of fraud, concern about that being just as dangerous as actual fraud, as absurd as that may sound, which was another argument that made its return in these arguments. This has actually been around for a long time, this from this right-wing court specifically, to argue that though there was virtually zero evidence of polling place impersonation fraud, the fact that people feared that it might happen, believed that it could, believed that it did because folks on Fox News and on the right claim that it does, that that alone, that fear of it actually happening was good enough to allow states to mandate strict voter ID restrictions at the polling place, even though millions of Americans might lose their vote. That's an old argument, but it came back. It's an oldie but goodie, Mark. It worked before, so why not now? Is that sort of how they treaded this thing out again?
That's it. And of course, you know, it cannot be said enough. There's no evidence of voter fraud on any mass scale in this country. It's random incidents that are often actually committed by Republicans. This is not to the extent it occurs, which is like once in a blue moon, something that Democrats seem to be doing to try to swing elections. But there is a circular logic here as well, which is that Republican politicians can claim there's voter fraud. There isn't. They can't prove it. But then they use the fears that they have whipped up about this phantom fraud to justify cracking down on the franchise and to justify new measures to suppress the vote. And that's what Justice Alito was doing. That's what Justice Kavanaugh was doing. They were saying, don't you think we should take into account fears of voter fraud, the appearance of fraud, and use it to justify striking down Mississippi's law? And I guess I just want to take a step back and say that this is not and barely pretends to be a legal argument, right? Because this is not like a legislative body deciding whether it's wise for states to count ballots that are postmarked on election day but arrive shortly thereafter. 30 states and the District of Columbia have in some way, shape, or form enacted these laws, okay? It's not the Supreme Court's job to decide whether they're wise. It's the Supreme Court's job to decide whether Congress quietly prohibited these laws when it used the words election day and day of the election in federal statutes enacted in the 19th century before there was widespread mail voting or early voting. And the answer, of course, obviously, is no. So what are these questions about voter fraud doing in these oral arguments? I mean, all I can really say is that it seems like these guys have forgotten what their jobs are, and they've been watching too much Fox News, and they are trying to impose Donald Trump's anti-voting agenda on the country in the guise of judicial review. I mean, look, there is a bill that Republicans support. It's part of this sort of SAVE Act suite of bills that would prohibit states from counting these later arriving ballots. But it hasn't passed, and it's probably not going to pass because it can't survive the filibuster. And this case is just an effort to smuggle that in to law and make Donald Trump very, very, very happy and disproportionately disenfranchise Democratic voters, because we know Democrats at this stage are more likely to vote by mail than Republicans. So that is what's going on here. There's very little law.
And I'm, again, need to underscore, it used to be very different. Republicans were far more likely to vote by mail than Democrats, and none of these issues came up for years and years and years when it was Republicans who were more often than not using vote by mail over Democrats. And to underscore this other point, Mark, even if the court's right wingers think that these laws, including, again, deep red Mississippi's law, for Christ's sake, when it comes to this grace period after Election Day to count late arriving mail ballots, even if the U.S. Supreme Court determines, well, that's a bad law, doesn't the Constitution allow that those states, Mississippi in this case, gets to make that bad law anyway, as long as it doesn't disenfranchise anybody's rights or anything else?
Yeah, yes. That is exactly the issue here, is who decides, something that Justice Jackson brought up. The Constitution says that states have primary authority to regulate federal elections and Congress can come in and override those decisions when it wants to. It does not say that judges should sit as a kind of council of revision and decide whether or not they think certain voting laws are wise and just and strike them down if they aren't. So the Constitution puts this in the hands of the people, and the people of the many states have decided that late arriving ballots should be counted. And one reason why, and this really got lost at arguments, but I think it's important to lift up, one reason why so many states have these laws is that military and overseas voters have long struggled to get their ballots in by election day, understandably, right? Have you ever tried to ship something abroad? It's not easy. Mm-hmm. If you're stationed on a military base, if you're living abroad, there are all kinds of logistical difficulties in getting these ballots back. So there are a lot of states that actually enacted these laws specifically to help military and overseas voters. Mm-hmm. And when Congress came in a few decades ago and issued these new rules about military and overseas voters, it specifically deferred to the state's ballot deadlines. So Congress knew at the time that some states were allowing these ballots to come in late as long as they were sent by election day. And Congress deferred to those laws in those statutes. And yet now we have, you know, these Republican politicians, these Republican lawyers claiming that Congress somehow wanted to ban states from counting late arriving ballots. The opposite is true. To the extent that there is any federal law on this, it's Congress saying, yes, states, you can count these late arriving ballots. We're deferring to your ballot deadlines. So this is, in addition to a completely absurd and fantastical legal theory, just flying in the face of support our troops, because what this theory would do in practice is ensure that a whole lot of service members who are serving in uniform abroad would not be able to have their votes counted in elections.
I'm old enough to remember Republicans making a whole lot of noise about that back in 2000 when the presidential race was ultimately decided in Florida by 537 votes. And Republicans were attacking Democrats for not allowing late arriving mail ballots from the military to show up. Now, we should note, Democrats actually did allow for late arriving military ballots to be included in the final totals. The fight was actually in that case about ballots, I think, that were not postmarked, that could have been sent at any time, even after the election. But the Democrats allowed it to, allowed those to be counted as well at the time, as Republicans insisted. Would an adverse ruling here in Watson v. RNC actually block those late military votes from being counted as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And Justice Sotomayor brought this up. She said we might have had a different president if this rule had been in effect in 2000 because of the issue of late arriving mail ballots from overseas for military voters, which Republicans fought tooth and nail to count during Bush v. Gore, because they suspected they would be disproportionately Democratic. You didn't hear them say back then that Congress had secretly banned late arriving ballots. Like, this is a very novel theory that was concocted only after Donald Trump's campaign against mail voting created a partisan split in mail voting that ensured that these ballots would be more likely to be cast by Democrats, meaning that any attack on mail voting would disproportionately hurt Democratic politicians.
I got to tell you, I mean, this whole case and the arguments that we heard seems just like a no-brainer. I mean, seems incredibly stupid to the question of why this is even being heard before the high court. Did the Solicitor General, the Mississippi Solicitor General, as noted, a Republican, do an effective job in rebutting these things?
So this Solicitor General, Scott Stewart, has appeared once before the Supreme Court before these arguments, and that was to defend Mississippi's abortion ban in Dobbs. This is a very conservative Republican who probably hated being put in the position of having to defend this law, and my sense was that his heart really was not in it, and that I don't think he threw the case. Like, I don't think that he lost it on purpose, and I don't know that he lost it at all, but he didn't raise the most robust or forceful defenses of the law that he could have. And by the way, there was a lot of reporting on these arguments that said, oh, it looks like Mississippi is going to lose and all these state laws are going to be thrown out. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that impression was created because the Mississippi Solicitor General did such a terrible job. Mm. And the justices were really beating him up. And he didn't have a particularly good response to Gorsuch's question. It took him a while to get to the point where he just said, by the way, recalling your ballot in Mississippi is illegal. You can't do it. And no one has ever done it before. He didn't have the right kind of responses to keep the arguments moving in his direction. And so I think that frustrated the justices. And when that happens, they tend to all kind of gang up, as occurred here. Mm. But I think there's still a chance that Mississippi could prevail and that these laws could survive, because you know, the early voting issue is paramount. And there is no defensible way to separate out late ballots from early ballots. And if the Supreme Court is going to crack down on early voting too, I mean, it's going to disrupt voting in every single state 150 days before the midterm elections. That seems like an unwise move. Now, the court has made unwise moves before, yeah. But even for this SCOTUS, I think it's a bridge too far.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because I wasn't able to watch the hearings, the oral argument live, or listen to it when it happened. I started seeing a lot of headlines about, you know, court seems inclined to overturn late mail-in ballots from a lot of outlets. I'm glad to hear that you are at least not quite as certain about that. Well, I'll get to that in a moment, but just a few more points here. If this were to be overturned, Mark, it would also mean that postal workers, if they wanted to, I guess, could purposely affect elections by slowing down delivery of mail. There was a recent case that it was decided that you could not sue a postal worker specifically for trying to delay your ballot. And I don't believe that postal workers at all would do this as a whole. But they've done it before. And if I have fears about them doing that, Mark, isn't that enough to do something about it? Just my fears alone?
Yes, it should be. It's an excellent point. I mean, I have.
Do we need to go on Fox News and promulgate this fear so that people have it, so that then we can get a decision from the Supreme Court on it?
I think so. I think that's a great move because surely the Supreme Court will be just as solicitous of progressives' concerns about mail voting as yes. Republicans' concerns. You know, I respect our mail carriers, but the reality is that it only takes a few bad apples to seriously wreck mail voting for entire communities.
Yep.
You know, think about how many parcels and pieces of mail one carrier delivers. There have been instances in just the last few years in which mm-hmm. individual postal workers have destroyed or delayed or refused to deliver hundreds of mail ballots, which mm-hmm. in a close election could be 537 votes. How about that? Could make all the difference. And I think this was like the worst possible time for the Supreme Court to take away our ability to sue the Postal Service for damages when this occurs, because the Postal Service needs to be on alert. It needs to have incentive to guard against this. It needs to know there will be serious consequences if postal workers do this. And the Supreme Court just put a shield around the Postal Service and made it impossible for anyone to sue for damages when their ballot is illegally withheld or destroyed. That is bad news. And it's part of a much broader assault on mail voting that we're seeing from the conservative justices at this moment.
If we get an adverse ruling here, an anti-voter ruling essentially here, are they talking about changing this rule for Mississippi and presumably about 29 other states before this year's elections, before this year's...
Yes.
What about this year's primaries? Would those be affected? I mean, we hear about this, you know, sort of applied or ignored whenever they want Purcell principle, which says that, you know, even good election law rulings cannot be applied too closely to an election because it would cause chaos in the election itself. Wouldn't that clearly be the case in this election?
Yes, yes. I mean, Justice Kavanaugh briefly brought up the Purcell principle and then basically waved it off and said, it didn't seem to interest him, didn't seem to bother him.
Was the guy last December who cited Purcell for this year's elections
who blocked a Texas ruling that would have thrown out a racial gerrymander because, it was too close to the elections in December of 2025.
Right.
It was too close to the November 2026 elections.
Yes.
But now they might throw out 30 state laws that allow for late arriving ballots 150 days before the midterms when primaries are ongoing. I mean, it's going to be chaos. And actually, a bunch of election administrators filed a brief in this case pointing the justices to these consequences, saying it would be chaotic, it would be terrible. And of course, it's just fundamentally stupid for our right to vote to rest on postal service delays, right? And by the way, Trump has been taking over the postal service. Mm-hmm. He has radically diminished its independence from the White House. He has installed a loyal ally as postmaster general. It's not good news over at USPS. And mm-hmm. so, I mean, look, I'm an advocate of mail voting. I always vote by mail here. But if you've got a drop box and you're anywhere near the yes. election, yes. I think the safest move these days is to put it in the drop box. And I think if the Supreme Court does take this step of striking down all these laws, then states like California are going to have to pass about build about 10 times more drop boxes on every single street yeah. corner, because we will no longer be able to rely on vote by mail.
You know, beyond drop boxes, I tell people, yeah, I mean, because a U.S. Postal Service box is, you know, talk about black boxes. You know, you drop it in, who knows if it gets there. A drop box is better specifically for ballots. Better still is delivering your ballot in person, if you can, to an election office or even to a precinct on election day. The closer you can get your ballot to the place that it is actually going to be tallied, the more safe your ballot is. Mark, I don't usually like to try and read the tea leaves based on justices' questions at oral arguments. You spoke about this a little bit, but I think we need to underscore it given the amount of coverage that I have seen that is pretty scary. This one really seems like it's going to come down to whatever it is that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett decide to do here, and they both will have to find against the Republican Party here to prevent this potential nightmare in our elections. No,
not very encouraging whenever we're having to rely on John and Amy to come to their senses. But, you know, there's an old saying that sometimes an opinion just won't write, that sometimes the justices swing one way, and then once they try to write the opinion, once they're circulating drafts, they realize this is all wrong. And I really think if there were ever an instance where that could happen, it would be here. Because again, you know, look, there are all these line drawing problems that Gorsuch and Thomas and Kavanaugh and Alito kept pointing out. You know, what if it's 10 days after the election? What if it's 21 days? What if it's a month after the election? What if your neighbor delivers it? What if FedEx yes. tries to recall it? But there's 10 times more line drawing problems on the other side. What about early voting? What about counting ballots after election day, yep. right? What about all the mail voting that occurs before the election? What about overseas voters? What about military voters? Are all those people going to be disenfranchised? What about the Purcell principle? You know, how come you're okay telling everybody in this country, or at least the majority of Americans who live in these 30 states, that the rules have changed months out from an election? And I hope that that will push John and Amy to their senses, but I cannot guarantee it, because of course they have made many senseless rulings over the last few years. Yeah. They will make many senseless rulings to come.
No kidding. And what about all male ballot states like Colorado, Oregon, Washington State, California, Nevada? I mean, this would be an utter nightmare. All of those people in all of those states would essentially have to vote by mail no later than a week before Election yep. Day in order to even try to come close to getting your ballot in time. It is insane. Mark Joseph Stern, you conclude at Slate in your piece by writing, even if the plaintiffs lose, plaintiffs being the RNC here, in a 5-4 ruling, and it is an if, that margin will be too close for comfort. A democracy that rests on the knife's edge of a single Supreme Court vote is living on borrowed time. Just because you were too optimistic about all of this, Mark, I needed to end it on a dark note, just to keep your reputation going, my friend.
I'm not sure optimism is the right word, but what I will say is that despair is never a helpful emotion when we are talking about the Supreme Court, and despair is what the bad guys want us to feel. So I am choosing to hold out some hope, but I do not encourage anyone to place any polymarket bets on the outcome that I foresee as possible. Because again, if you bet on this court doing the worst thing imaginable, that bet quite often pays off.
Mark Joseph Stern covers the law, the court system, Supreme Court, and much else over at Slate.com. He is always a must read, and he is a must follow over on the Blue Skies, where you can find him at MJS DC. Always a delight, sir. Always an honor. Thanks for joining us today, my friend.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
And by the way, he is also right on the money when it comes to despair. Never being helpful. Exactly what the bad guys want us to feel. They want us to feel despair, terror, helplessness, and everything else.
So he chooses hope. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, don't fall for it. Don't give the bad guys what they want. All right, quick break. And the good guys want to hear from Desi Doyen with her latest Green News Report. That is straight ahead on today's broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.
And now I'm seeing it again, just in from CNN. The Supreme Court's conservatives appear ready to impose mail-in ballot deadlines, one of two cases that could alter the 2026 midterms. We will see, because I'm hearing that from a lot. CNN, New York Times, AP, they're all like, oh, looks like the court is ready to end late mail-in ballots. We'll see. I hope they are wrong. And Mark Joseph Stern's hopeful look, if that's the right word, it turns out to be the right one. In any event, got to get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
I've directed the Department of War to temporarily postpone planned strikes against major energy and electricity targets in Iran.
Trump backs off threat to bomb Iran's power plants, which would be a war crime. New analysis finds the U.S.-Israeli war on Iran is a disaster for the climate and the environment. Plus,
climate scientists have said that this heat wave that they're experiencing at the minute in the United States would have been virtually impossible without human-induced climate change.
Extreme heat wave in western U.S. really was historic.
All of that real-life history and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We've had very good discussions. Very, very good discussions.
Sure you have, champ. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, as we go to air, a massive explosion and fire late on Monday evening at the Valero Refinery in Port Arthur, Texas, one of the largest refineries in the U.S. So far, no reports of injury or death, though no one knows exactly what caused it. At the same time, I'm happy to report no sun or wind explosions today here in the U.S.
So at least there's that.
Yeah, it's nice. What do you got for us today?
Well, as we go to air, Donald Trump on Monday backed off his threat to, quote, obliterate Iran's civilian power plants if they didn't reopen the Strait of Hormuz immediately, through which about 20% of the world's supply of oil and gas and fertilizer travels. Trump claimed his administration is in talks to end the war with Iran that he started, but Iranian officials said that was not true. Critics say that Trump's assertion was possibly a ploy to manipulate skyrocketing global oil prices. Trump, over the weekend, lifted sanctions on Iranian oil already at sea in an effort to calm oil markets. It was a contradictory move that allows Iran to profit from this war.
And, of course, that follows on the lifting of sanctions against Russian oil. So Russia and Iran are doing pretty well by this war, it seems.
Yes, they are. Industry experts say that whenever the conflict ends, it could take months to restore oil and gas production and shipping, and long-term economic disruption is now baked into the system for months to come.
Oh, it'll be fine. Trump totally knew what he was doing. This was completely on purpose. I can't believe you'd even question such a thing.
The Guardian reports on the first analysis of the environmental cost of the Iran war. The Climate and Community Institute analysis found massive increases in air and water pollution and a burst of climate warming carbon emissions in just 14 days, caused by widespread destruction of infrastructure, buildings, and missile attacks on oil and gas facilities that released toxic contaminants into the air, water, and soil, like that oil depot explosion that generated black acid rain across Tehran. With so much of the world's oil and gas production now offline, Heatmap News reports that the oil and gas supply shock is already leading to major changes around the world. In Australia, gas stations are running out of diesel. The Philippines government adopted a four-day work week to reduce commuting. Pakistan closed schools for 2 weeks, and Nepal is rationing cooking fuel.
Other than that, it's all going very well.
Here in the U.S., that unprecedented massive extreme heat dome that baked the Southwest really was historic, setting a new all-time national heat record for the month of March. Forecasters say the heat dome is expanding eastward and is one of the geographically largest heat waves in American history. Climate scientists at World Weather Attribution found that the record heat was, quote, virtually impossible without climate change and was made 800 times more likely because of the burning of fossil fuels. Dr. Michael Mann on MS Now explains that there's actually worse news.
Those heat domes that we hear about, they are probably becoming more persistent as well because of changes in the behavior of the jet stream that are linked to human-caused warming. And so if anything, the models that we rely upon may be underestimating the impact that climate change is having on these sorts of extremes.
Oh, fantastic.
Meanwhile, in the middle of skyrocketing gas and electricity prices
and heat domes,
the Trump administration succeeded in killing off two proposed offshore wind farms that would have helped with that. French company Total Energies accepted the Trump Interior Department's offer to pay them $1 billion in public funds to cancel two offshore wind leases for the coasts of North Carolina and New York and redirect that money to oil and gas projects instead.
$1 billion in U.S. taxpayer dollars given to a French company to not build wind power off the coast.
Yep.
Brilliant. He really is the master negotiator. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's getting better all the time.
Isn't it? It's fantastic. It's getting better. Hey, this just in from AP, the U.S. is preparing to send about 1,000 troops from an Army airborne unit to the Middle East, says an AP source. Well, we can add that to several thousand that we've heard headed that are headed out to the Middle East over the past few days. It really does start to feel like we're about to put boots on the ground, but we will see. Yep. We will pick up that conversation, I suspect, on tomorrow's broadcast when we're joined by Driftglass and Heather Digby Parton.
Yep.
Until then, my thanks again to our guest today, Mark Joseph Stern of Slate, to our producer, Desi Doyen, to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it for free anytime at bradblog.com. But while you're there, please consider hitting a donate button to help us stay on your public airwaves. Thank you. Drop me an email on bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the social medias, you will find me at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Till we see you here next time, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Better all the time. It's getting better all the time.